Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference one word at a time. Now, here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, everyone. Welcome. My guest today says who we are with dogs is who we are as people. And the book we're talking about is Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond. My guest is Alexandra Horowitz. She's the author of three previous books, Being a Dog, Onlooking, and Inside of a Dog. She's a professor at Barnard College, Columbia University, where she teaches seminars in canine cognition, creative nonfiction writing, and audio storytelling. And again, we're talking about her latest book today, Our Dogs, Ourselves. Welcome, Alexandra Horowitz.
Thank you very much.
Well, you don't know this probably, but it's actually 10 years almost to the month that we spoke last time.
Fantastic.
We spoke about Inside of a Dog in 2009. And I'm really pleased to see this new book out. Found it utterly fascinating, as I did your other book. It takes a slightly different approach. It explores us as humans as much as it does dogs and our relationship with our dogs, how our behavior affects them. So what drove you to write Our Dogs, Ourselves?
Well, you're right. Most of my research and my writing has been about dog cognition, which is the thing that I study as a scientist. You know, what is it like to be a dog? How can we use their behavior to learn something about their minds? And I actually study dogs in a lab here at Barnard College, which is to say I have owners and their dogs come into a room where I have set up a simple experimental puzzle for the dogs, and it's kind of a game, and they'll do some behavior, and it allows me to make some inferences about what they know. And as I say, they come with their people, these dogs. They're not volunteers on their own, right? It's their right. Owners who volunteer them. And it's a really interesting dynamic, obviously, watching humans with dogs. And of course, I am a person who lives with dogs as well, but when I'm in that context as a scientist looking at this familiar animal, dogs, objectively, I also started to see this dynamic between the person and dog. And I got more and more interested in why were they talking to the dogs the way they were? You know, how did it come to be that dogs were to be arriving with the certain paraphernalia that they were arriving with, the leash and the harness or the carried in a tote bag? You know, how did all of these ways that we just ordinarily deal with our dogs, how did that come up? And so this book is my exploration of that.
And so, you know, I think I just want to throw this in there, because when I was looking at your bio, I thought, what a great career you have, because in addition to working with dogs, my favorite animals, you teach creative nonfiction writing, you teach audio storytelling. How did this all come together for you?
Fairly organically, not with any a priori ideas about what was going to happen. When I started studying dogs, that was kind of accidental. I was just looking at non-human animal minds and wanted to study play behavior. And it turned out that the most playful subject was the one who lived in my house, you know, dogs. I wound up studying them for my dissertation, and then dogs just became an interesting subject to study. So I went with that. And as I did that, I thought I have to turn to writing about the research that's budding in this field, because as an owner, the person who lives with a dog, it's relevant to my life. It's changed how I see my dog. So I started writing about it. And along the way, you know, I'm teaching classes that kind of match my research and other work. And so across the last, I guess, 15, 20 years, I couldn't have imagined it, but now you're right. I get to study dogs and write about dogs and teach about them and about writing about them for a living, which is pretty great.
Yeah, pretty cool. And you do such a good job of it too. You take a very controversial approach in the book to what you term de-sexing. And you say if there's a topic we can't talk about with dogs, then that's exactly the topic we should be talking about. So tell us what you mean by that. Obviously, we're talking about spaying and neutering, and a great deal of money is spent on advertising, and we think that's the thing we should do to prevent shelters full of dogs. So what do you have to say about that?
Well, it's interesting that you say take a controversial kind of approach on spaying and neutering, because really all I'm doing in the book is I bring up the topic for discussion, and I point out that it's not the simple solution to the problem that it was set out to solve, which was overpopulation, that it's kind of made out to be and held out to be. And there are all sorts of complexities in that choice, and there are also these secondary results of that choice, where there is good research showing that there are some really detrimental effects of spaying, neutering on dogs. And so what I'm interested in with that chapter, as throughout the book, is to discuss things that have become so familiar and we're so accustomed to that we've kind of stopped looking at them or examining them again. So I never think that that's not worth doing.
No, I totally agree with you. We get in this mindset of this is the way it's done. And, you know, I've had dogs all my life, and I can remember we had a beagle who misbehaved terribly. He was a wonderful dog, but he just didn't want to behave. Probably having three kids in the house didn't help, right? And I remember my dad having him neutered, saying, you know, this will calm him down, but it didn't seem to have that effect. And you do discuss that in the book. You know, maybe it's more about socializing our animals.
Yeah. In fact, a lot of kind of dialogue around spaying and neutering is that to be a responsible dog owner, you need to spay or neuter your dog, de-sex them. And it does seem to imply that at some level, then your duties as a responsible dog owner are kind of done, right? And as for me, when because I'm interested in, you know, what's the dog's experience of living in a human-guided world, I'm always noting how much of their perceived misbehavior is a result of just a poor communication between person and dog, or, you know, lack of mutual understanding, essentially, more than anything else. So the whole notion that a kind of surgery might solve a problem, which really is due to a mutual misunderstanding, seems to me reductionist, right? Too simplistic. And as you say, that's one of the widely held beliefs about neutering a male dog, is that their aggression tendencies or their misbehavior will be reduced. And the facts don't seem to bear that out. So if that's what one is doing to solve the problem, I think we have to look again in a different way.
Right, you're right. I want to jump from that to personality tests that you talk about, because they're kind of linked there. You say our temperaments match our dogs. People who score high on traits of anxiety or neuroticism are likely to have anxious or neurotic dogs, which I've always believed too. And I had a classic example with a friend who has two dogs who are insane, lovely dogs, but they're just insane. When they come to stay with me, they're actually really well behaved, but she is extremely high energy, extremely dramatic, and when they're with her, they're not quite so well behaved. So talk to us a little bit about that and how we impact them in that way.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that fact comes from a couple of things. When we actually do choose dogs who at some level match us, right? So there's a little bit of choice of a dog that kind of we see in ourselves that reflects us at some level. And then behavior and emotions are very contagious with dogs. So dogs are quite sensitive to how we behave, the things that cause us anxiety, the things that cause us to startle, and that contagion can kind of work its way down the leash. So it's not at all surprising to see people who are highly anxious who have highly anxious dogs, and unfortunately it compounds itself, right? Seeing a highly anxious dog, and feeling concerned about their behavior might even make the owner more anxious. So we have to think of them as these highly sensitive beings who we have alongside us, who will wind up reflecting us in many ways.
Yeah, I notice, you know, when I'm walking my border collie every day, there are some people who see him and instantly pick up their dog because they're afraid something's going to happen between the dogs. And the dog, that's so transferred to the dogs that it changes their behavior then every time they see another dog, right?
Right, absolutely. So there's this is a horrible vicious cycle that happens where people perceive, and there certainly are dogs who cannot interact with other dogs safely.
Yeah.
But I have seen a growing trend of people being concerned if their dog is barking at another dog, for instance, when you pass on the street. Barking is not always aggressive. It's a kind of communication, so you have to be pretty well-tuned to what the bark is. But if you perceive it as aggressive, then your way of solving the problem might be, if you have a small dog, to pick them up, as you say. But then what happens? You know, you don't let the dog ever actually interact with other dogs, and so they might get more excited when they see other dogs, right? There's a frustration that compounds the reaction. So I think we contribute to some of the difficulties and what we actually describe as misbehavior in dogs in our attempt, you know, good-hearted attempt to avoid conflicts.
Yeah. Another thing that always amazes me, and we kind of touched a little on this last time, but you talk about this in the book, is how uncomfortable some dog owners get when dogs meet, you know, and they sniff each other's butts and they try and mount each other, which is perfectly natural dog behavior, but they get very embarrassed when people fight. So talk to us about that and why it's natural and what's really going on there.
Yeah, I think this is one of the most interesting phenomena of the human-dog interaction, is that we see their behavior as reflecting us in many respects. So many people want to have a polite dog because they perceive themselves as polite and they think it's important to deal with others politely. And, of course, what counts for dogs as polite is very different than what counts for us as polite. So we're kind of imposing our ideas of politeness on the dog, and in some ways that's really inapt. Dogs mounting other dogs is one of the classic cases where that's actually just a tool that dogs use in play, just like any other behavior that they use, which isn't intended to be domineering or dominant. It might not be liked by the other dog, but that other dog can certainly let them know, and isn't really sexual at all. It's just a way that they get excited about and interact with other dogs. But we want to put a stop to it because certainly we don't want to go up to somebody we don't know and do this, like, overtly, what looks like an overtly sexual act. Even sniffing another dog very closely is sometimes discouraged because we think that that's kind of intrusive. The personal space that dogs will allow themselves with each other is really different than the personal space that two strangers will allow with each other.
Mm.
We never go up to somebody and sniff them,
no.
Frankly, right? That would be considered really bizarre. And so we think a dog maybe should not as well. But if you keep them from sort of meeting each other and finding out who the other is, and they do that via these very close sniffs, then you're asking for some other maybe difficult behavior to rise based on the frustration of that.
Yeah. I always tell people when they say, oh, I'm so sorry. I always say, don't worry about it. If you were doing that to me, it would be a whole different story.
Yeah.
So you talked in the beginning about, you know, one of the reasons you were interested in writing this book is why we talk to dogs. Why do we talk to dogs? What's going on there? Because I talk to mine all the time.
I should say that, you know, I really love the way we talk to dogs. We are, and I include myself among dog people here, you know, regularly turning to the dog and communicating with them as though they are really understanding what we're saying, as though we're in conversation. And I started listening for people's conversations with their dogs, and there are all manner of conversations. These are not just instructions that people are giving. They're really, you know, questions that they're asking about their preference, about the dog's preferences. They're observations that they're sharing with their dogs. And sometimes I even like leave a little beat after saying something to let the dog respond, you know, and then the dog says nothing and then they continue. And I think in many respects, our talking to dogs reflects that we have considered them part of our kind of intimate circle, part of our family. And just the way you're always talking when you're in the company of your family, here is another sentient creature who you're keeping company with, and you're going to include them in the conversation. And it kind of doesn't matter that they don't say anything back.
Right, right. Well, last time we spoke, you burst one of my bubbles about do dogs love us? but that was 10 years ago. And just actually last week, I spoke with canine behaviorist Dr. Clive Wynn, who wrote Dog is Love, Why Your Dog Loves You. And as the title implies, he says his latest research shows without any doubt that dogs do love us. Whether it's the way that we love them is a whole different subject. But according to MRIs, you know, their brain lights up the same way, et cetera, et cetera. And it's a fairly recent conclusion. So I'm wondering what you have to say about that now.
Right. No, actually, I don't think we're in disagreement, Clive and I. And I don't think I would have said, or maybe we can go back and look at the tape, but I don't think I would have said dogs don't love you. It's always been that there's a level of understanding of what their experience is that we, as scientists, have to be quiet about. It's the sort of subjective feeling of what it's like to have an emotion. So dogs have a wide range of emotions, but what I think people are interested in when they say, does my dog love me, is does my dog feel exactly as I feel about him or her toward me, right? And I can't see how that would be exactly the case. It certainly is the case that they are attached to us, that they have affection for us. What looks to us like love, we could call it love, but what seems to me the shorthand that I would avoid assenting to is that just because we have the same neural activity, we have the same experience, I don't think that's the case about you and me, right?
Right.
Our experiences of love are different, and I want to honor the differences of a dog's experience. I'm not trying to diminish them. I want to honor that they are a radically different animal than we are, in some ways probably more sophisticated and complex and interesting than the human mind. For instance, their world is made up of scents and odors, where we're barely acknowledging scents or odors. And in other ways, just simply different than ours. So I think we diverge, Clive and I might diverge on that point. He says, oh, you might as well call it love. And I say, you know, I think it's going to be something different. And as a shorthand, you could call it love. But I think that doesn't do service to the richness of the dog's experience.
Right, right. And to be clear, you did not categorically say they do not love us last time we talked.
Oh, yeah.
I did listen back to that tape. But, you know, I said you burst my bubble because you said there may be other reasons and other things going on, which is basically what you just said there, too. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, you know, I do think that part of science is just exploring what it's like to be another animal. And with the dog, it's an interesting subject because people who live with dogs kind of might look to science to have answers to their questions. And sometimes science just can't really answer the specific question that owners of dogs have. So we try to use whatever we can answer to try to answer that question. In some ways, though, there's an important gap. So, like, you know, saying that the same area of our brain is active is really, in my mind, to say nothing about the dog's subjective experience. But it is the only kind of evidence we have that can potentially answer the question. So I think that's what happens.
Yeah. So I want to talk about what I consider a very serious issue that we have now, and that I some time ago talked with Madeline Bernstein, who's president of SPCA in Los Angeles, and she joined us to talk about the cruel and dangerous underworld of designer dogs. Cruel because many of these animals are mistreated, and you know, they're just used as breeding machines. They're often let go far too early from their parents, from their mother. And, you know, breeders are concerned more about hard cash than the dog's welfare. And then dangerous because much of it's not legal, etc. So one of the things you talk about in the book is pure breeding. And I mean, this happens with designer dogs and it happens with pure breeding. So talk to us a little bit about what we need to know about breeding and why it's dangerous to crossbreed to create those designer dogs and even purebred dogs to the point of perfection that we're looking for.
Right. It's such an interesting thing to think about, you know, what a purebred dog is, what a mixed breed dog is. I think people are often surprised to learn that what we think of as a dog, you know, if I ask you to think of a dog, many people will come up with in their minds a purebred dog. But these various dogs that we now see are actually very recent in our history. It's the late 19th century that people began purebreeding dogs, and that's different than the dogs that were around before, which certainly were different types, in that people began creating a closed genetic pool from which you could draw dogs who would be considered true members of a breed. So what you require to do pure breeding at that level and what is now required is actually inbreeding, which is breeding with a very close relative. And, you know, we've all had biology class. We know reasons that that could be detrimental. There is certainly the possibility that recessive genes, which are harmful, are more likely to appear in the offspring of two closely related animals or who have that same gene. So it's increasing genetic mutations to just breed from a closed gene pool. And furthermore, we've been breeding for appearance, what's called form in the field, as opposed to function, like what the dog looks like versus what the dog does. And that's been very detrimental to a number of purebred dogs. And that's also how you come up with this whole designer dog phenomenon, is people want a dog who looks cute in a certain way.
Instagram
friends, for instance, are all about, I like this, like, you know, fluffy mop-headed dog. It looks really cute for me. I want to get one of those. And so that's going to encourage breeding just for looks, without any regard for the health of the dogs. And similarly, the purebred dogs who have been bred, for instance, to have a flat face because we find that cute with the very short noses, the brachycephalic dogs, they have real diminishment in health, a serious problem breathing, being birthed naturally, and so forth, because we've just been breeding them for looks. So I think that's the driving problem that I see with some of these practices, which absolutely could be changed, right? They're within our power to change.
Right, right. So I've always heard, I was always believed that mutts, when they're not bred so closely like that, tend to generally be healthier. Have you found that to be true in science, or is that just a myth?
Yes, no, that's widely known that there is health in crossbreeding. Now, there could be dogs who were themselves not healthy, and mutts often are not intentionally bred, right? They're sort of self-selecting. So a dog could choose another dog with which it's a bad mate, and the resultant offspring would also be unhealthy. But on the whole, if one had to generalize across the population, yeah, because of the inbreeding problems, they are likelier to be healthier.
Yeah, interesting. Well, they say we pick dogs who look like us. You say, yeah, who we are with dogs is who we are as people. Tell us what you mean by that.
I think that how we treat this other animal who we have domesticated, you know, we've changed from a resourceful carnivore who could live on their own and brought them into our homes, and provide them with a certain kind of standard of living, but also in some cases kind of mistreat them in various ways, you know, maybe breeding them to be sold, for instance, without regard to their health, or the various ways that other ways that dogs, very sad ways that dogs are mistreated. I think both of those types of things reflect a lot on us as humans, right? That we are open-hearted enough to bring a non-human animal into our lives and treat them as members of the family is profoundly demonstrative of our empathy for an interest in others, right? I mean, I think kind of fantastic. We get no specific thing from them, but their companionship, which is profound, but they're no use. They're not helping to support us in a more explicit way. So that's on the one hand. And on the other hand, you know, the fact that they're a social animal, they like to be around others, and as American dog owners, we often leave our dogs for most of the day by themselves. You know, that tells us something else, that as much as we love them as part of our family, we're willing to let them, you know, suffer to some small degree all the time, right? So it's, I think that our ways of dealing with them, the ways we've developed laws, the ways we buy things for them, all reflect interesting components of who we are as humans in this day and age.
Yeah, and you alluded to this, that, 95% of people polled in the U.S. consider dogs our family, and yet the law sees them as property. How do we get that changed?
The law has run a kind of parallel but non-intersecting course with the developing feelings we've had about dogs. So the laws about dogs as objects comes from, historically, from the beginnings of our organizing objects into either persons or property. So everything to the law is either a person, like human beings are considered under the person categories, but so are things like corporations or business entities. And those are things that can own property, and then everything else is considered property. So you have now a dog member of the family whose value to the law is only what you paid for them, which is obviously incommensurate with how we feel about members of our family. And I think that's because the law has not changed at all as our ideas about dogs have changed over the last 200 years to reflect their place in our life. It's still that early division of objects into one of two categories, one that can own the other, one that has rights, the other that has none. And I do think there are people thinking right now about how to change that binary to make dogs have a more a place in law that more reflects what their place is in our lives.
Yeah, I'd like to see that. Well, the book is called Our Dogs, Ourselves, The Story of a Singular Bond. My guest, Alexandra Horowitz. Awesome read, Alexandra. Great information in there. Final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think that dogs have done us a great service living in our lives, and I hope that people look at the book as a way to rethink the policies that don't work in honoring dogs.
Lovely.
And that's it.
Lovely.
Thank you.
Thank you. And you can find out more about Our Dogs Ourselves at Alexandra's website, alexandrahorowitz.net. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Vicki. Thanks for having me again.
Radio is very competitive. Shows soar in popularity and then flame out. Sometimes, however, a real connection is made with an audience, and success blooms year after year. For over a decade, Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair has built a loyal following thanks to inspiring and stimulating conversation. Longevity, loyalty, exclusivity. Smart advertisers seek it out. With Vicki's valuable audience, the search is over. Discover the affordable, effective ways to advertise your business. Log on to conversationslive.net. That's conversationslive.net today.